"We will not start from Bulawayo," Jamieson replied evenly. "I have the approval of the British government to maintain a mobile armed force in Bechuanaland, on the railway concession strip which runs down the border of the Transvaal. The force is for the protection of the railway, but it will be based at Pitsani, a mere 180 miles from Johannesburg. We can be there in 50 hours' hard riding, long before the Boers can raise any kind of resistance." It was at that moment that Ralph realized that it was feasible. Given Dr. Leander Star Jamieson's legendary luck, they could pull it off. They could take the Transvaal with the same ease as they had seized Matabele land from Lobengula. By God, what a prize that would be! £1 billion sterling in gold, annexed to Rhodes's own land, Rhodesia. After that, everything else was possible. British Africa, a whole continent. Ralph was stunned at the magnitude of the design. It was Zuga Ballantyne again who unerringly identified the fatal flaw in the scheme. "What is the position of Her Majesty's government? Will they support us?" he asked. "Without them, it will be in vain."
"I have just returned from London," Mr. Rhodes replied. "While I was there, I dined with the Colonial Secretary, Mr. Joseph Chamberlain. As you know, he has instilled a new spirit of vigour and determination into Downing Street. He is in complete sympathy with the plight of our subjects in Johannesburg. He is also fully aware of the dangers of German intervention in southern Africa. Let me just assure you all that Mr. Chamberlain and I understand each other. I can say no more at this stage. You must trust me."
If that is true, Ralph thought, then the chances of complete success were better than ever. The swift thrust to the heart of the unprepared enemy, the uprising of armed citizenry, the appeal to a magnanimous British government, and finally, the annexation. As he listened to the planning, Ralph was swiftly calculating the consequences of the successful outcome of the plot. The chief of these was that the British South Africa Company and De Beers Consolidated Diamond Company would become the richest and most powerful commercial enterprises on the face of the earth. And they were all Mr. Rhodes's alter ego. Ralph's anger and hatred returned so fiercely that his hands trembled, and he had to place them carefully in his lap. But still he could not prevent himself glancing at his younger brother. Jordan was staring at Mr. Rhodes with such an expression of naked adoration that Ralph was certain that every other man at the table must see it too, and he was sickened with shame. He need not have concerned himself. They were all caught up in the glory and grandeur of one man's dream, carried forward by the charisma and compelling leadership of the shaggy colossus at the head of the table. Yet it was still Zuga, the pragmatic soldier, who probed for flaws and faults. "Dr. Jim, will you be raising all 600 men here in Rhodesia?" he asked. "For reasons of secrecy and expediency, we cannot raise them in Cape Colony, or anywhere else for that matter," Jamieson nodded. "With the Rinderpest scourge having swept away their fortunes, there will be that number and more of our young Rhodesians eager to enlist, if only for the pay and the rations, and all of them will be good fighting men who rode against the Matabele. Do you think it wise to leave this country stripped bare of its able-bodied men?" Mr. Rhodes frowned quickly as he intervened.
"It would be only for a few short months, and we do not have an enemy to fear, do we?"
"Don't we?" Zuga asked. "There are tens of thousands of Matabele." "Oh, come now, Major," Jamieson cut in. "The Matabele are a defeated and disorganized rabble. General St. John will be acting administrator of the territory in my absence. Perhaps he is the best person to set your fears at rest." They all looked to the tall man at Jamieson's side, and Mungo St. John removed the long cheroot from his mouth and smiled, crinkling the corner of his single eye. "I have 200 armed native police whose loyalty is unquestioned. I have informers placed in every large Matabele village who will give me warning of any stirrings. No, Major. I give you my assurance that the only enemy we need take into account is the obstinate old Boer in Pretoria. I accept that from a soldier of General St. John's calibre," said Zuga simply, and turned back to Mr. Rhodes. "Can we discuss the details of the raising of this force? How much money do we have at our disposal?" Ralph watched their faces as they planned and argued, and with surprise saw that his own father's was as greedy and eager as any of them. Whatever words came from their mouths, Ralph thought, whatever they seem to be talking about, what they are actually talking about is money. Suddenly, Ralph remembered that dawn over the barren Karoo, when he had knelt alone in the desert and sworn an oath, calling on God to witness it. And he now had to use all his willpower to prevent himself from looking up at Mr. Rhodes. He knew that this time he could not conceal it from him. So he kept his eyes on the crystal glass of cognac in front of him, while he strove for self-control and forced himself to think dispassionately. If it were possible to destroy this giant of a man, was it not also possible to destroy his company? To wrest from it the powers of government and the land rights and the mineral rights that it held over all Rhodesia? Ralph felt the thrill of it humming through his blood, as he realized that this might be not only the chance for fierce vengeance, but also for vast fortune within his grasp. If the plot failed, then the shares of the gold mining companies involved, Cornerhouse Mining Group, Rand Mines, Consolidated Goldfields, would all crash with it. A simple bare coup on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange could net millions of pounds. Ralph Ballantyne felt a sense of awe at the magnitude of the prospect that faced him. A prospect of power and wealth such as he had never dreamed of until this moment. He almost missed the question and looked up when Mr. Rhodes repeated it.
I said, how soon can you leave for Kimberley to take charge of the shipments, Ralph?
Tomorrow, Ralph replied.
I knew we could rely upon you, Mr. Rhodes nodded.
Ralph had lingered deliberately to be the last to leave King's Lynn. Now he and his father stood on the veranda and watched the dust column raised by Mr. Rhodes's mule coach dwindling away down the hill. Ralph leaned against one of the whitewashed pillars that supported the roof, with his sun-browned muscular arms folded across his chest and his eyes crinkled against the spiralling smoke of the cheroot between his teeth. "You aren't naive enough to accept young Percy's estimate of the Boers, are you, Papa?" Zuga chuckled. "Slow, suspicious, malevolent, and all that nonsense," he shook his head. "They ride hard and shoot straight. They have fought every black tribe south of the Limpopo." "Not to mention our own soldiers," Ralph reminded him. "Majuba Hill, 1881. General Colley and 90 of his men were buried on the peak. The Boers didn't lose a single man." "They are good soldiers," Zuga admitted. "But we will have surprise on our side." "However, you do agree that it'll be an act of international banditry, Papa." Ralph removed the cheroot from his mouth and tapped off the ash. "We won't have one shred of moral justification for it." Ralph watched the scar on Zuga's cheek turn white as bone china. It was an infallible barometer of his mood. "I do not understand," Zuga said. But they both knew he understood perfectly. "It's robbery," Ralph persisted. "Not just a little footpaddery, but robbery on the grand scale. We are plotting to steal a country." "Did we steal, then, this land from the Matabele?" Zuga demanded. "That was different," Ralph smiled. "They were pagan savages. But here we are planning to overthrow a government of fellow Christians."
"When we consider the greater good of the empire..." Zuga's scar had turned from icy white to crimson.
"Empire, Papa?" Ralph was still smiling. "If there are two people who should be entirely honest with each other, they are you and me. Look at me and tell me straight that there'll be no profit in it for us, other than the satisfaction of having done our duty to the empire." But Zuga did not look at him. "I am a soldier." "Yes," Ralph cut him short. "But you are also a rancher who has just come through the Rinderpest. You managed to sell 5,000 head of cattle, but we both know that was not enough. How much do you owe, Papa?" After a moment's hesitation, Zuga told him grudgingly.
£30,000.
"Do you have any expectation of paying off those debts?"
"No."
"Not unless we take the Transvaal."
Zuga did not reply, but the scar faded, and he sighed.
"All right," Ralph told him. "I just wanted to be certain that I was not alone in my motives."
"You will go through with it?" Zuga asked. "Don't worry, Papa, we'll come out of it, I promise you that." Ralph pushed himself away from the pillar and called to the grooms to bring his horse. From the saddle he looked down at his father and for the first time noticed how the weariness of age had faded the green of his eyes. "My boy, just because some of us will be rewarded for our endeavours, it does not mean that the enterprise is not a noble one. We are the servants of the Empire, and faithful servants are entitled to a fair wage." Ralph reached down and clasped his shoulder. Then he picked up the reins and rode down the hill through the acacia forests. The railhead was feeling its way up the escarpment like a cautious adder, often following the ancient elephant roads, for these huge beasts had pioneered the easiest gradients and the gentlest passes. It had left the swollen baobabs and yellow fever trees of the Limpopo Basin far below, and the forests were lovelier, the air sweeter, and the streams clearer and colder. Ralph's base camp had moved up with the railhead into one of the secluded valleys just out of earshot of the hammers of the gangs driving the steel spikes into the teak railway sleepers. The spot had many of the charms of the remote wilderness. In the evenings, a herd of sable antelope came down to feed in the grass glade below the camp, and the barking of baboons from the hills roused them each dawn. Yet the telegraph hut at the railhead was 10 minutes' stroll away, around the foot of the wooded hill, and the locomotive bringing up the rails and sleepers from Kimberley delivered as well the latest copy of the Diamond Fields Advertiser, and any other small luxuries that the camp required. In an emergency, Cathy would have the railway overseer and any men of his gang to call upon, while the camp itself was protected by 20 loyal Matabele servants and Isasi, the little Zulu driver, who pointed out modestly that he alone was worth 20 more of the bravest Matabele. In the unlikely event of Cathy becoming lonely or bored, the Harkness mine was only 30 miles away, and Harry and Vicky promised to ride across every weekend.
"Can't we come with you, Daddy?" Jonathan pleaded. "I could help you, really, I could."
Ralph lifted him into his lap. "One of us has to stay and look after Mama," he explained. "You are the only one I can trust."
"We can take her with us," Jonathan suggested eagerly.
And Ralph had a vision of his wife and child in the midst of an armed revolution, with barricades in the streets and Boer commandos ravaging the countryside.
"That'd be very nice, John," Ralph agreed. "But what about the new baby? What happens if the stork arrives here while we are all away and there's nobody to sign for your little sister?"
Jonathan scowled. He was already developing a healthy dislike for this not-yet-arrived but eternally present female personage. She seemed to stand squarely in the way of every pleasant prospect or exciting plan. Both parents managed to introduce his darling sister into almost every conversation, and his mother spent much of the time formerly devoted to Master Jonathan's interests in knitting and sewing or just sitting smiling to herself. She no longer went out riding with him each morning and evening, nor indulged in those rowdy romps which he enjoyed so heartily. Jonathan had in fact already consulted Itzazi on the possibility of getting a message to the stork and telling him not to bother, that they had changed their minds. However, Itzazi had not been very encouraging, although he had promised to have a word with the local witch doctor on Jonathan's behalf.